Hi from Holden Village on this beautiful 4th of July morning. Christine Carlson leads the Bible study this morning, and it's entitled Community Issues in Romans, and it's entitled Freedom. So let's move to the fireside room here at Koinonia Building in Holden and pick up on what they're talking about in the Bible study.
This is going to be a shorter Bible study this morning. It will be just 45 minutes. Brunch starts at 9:45. And as I was thinking about this, I thought the minute the brunch bell rings, if you're as hungry as I am, your mind is going to be going up there, if not your body with your stomach in it. So when it's 9:45 and the brunch bell rings, we just will finish. So this is a shorter Bible study. The rest of the days this week will each be an hour in length, but this had to be shortened. And as a result, we will have less discussion this morning. I always like Bible study with opportunities for discussion, but that will be shortened this morning, and we'll just do a little group talking. I won't break you up into smaller groups to talk like we will other days this week. So just that you know what's going on there. The theme of the Bible studies this week is community issues in Romans. And so we'll be looking at Paul's letter to the Romans in the New Testament. And look, I've just pulled out some issues that I think are important for community life. And I thought for our life here at Holden, as well as for our lives back home when we leave here, community issues are very important. And I think for our time and place, they're especially important. So I hope that this will be Bible study that feeds you, and whether you're here for one time or all the times, I hope that it enriches your life and gives you good guidance here at Holden and when you go. Come on in. Just be sure that you grab a Bible. That's the main thing. It will help the study this morning. I'll give you a minute to get seated here before we go on. Make sure you get a Bible. Yes? Okay, I'll talk about myself. Well, everybody's coming in. My name is Christine Carlson. I live in Northfield, Minnesota. I'm here for 2 weeks with my husband, whose name is Morris Wee, and our three sons, Kai, who's 12, Anders, who's 9, and Olaf, who's 4. So that tells you, I think, alone that our lives are busy. In Northfield, my husband is a pastor at St. John's Lutheran Church, and I'm a graduate student in a doctoral program in New Testament at Luther Seminary in St. Paul. So I commute up to classes. I'm also an ELCA pastor. I served a congregation until my second son was born, and then that got to be too much for me, so I have been doing other things for a while. I hope to get back to that, because I miss it very much. But the other thing I'd want you to know about me, I guess, is that just about my favorite thing to do in the world is Bible study. So I'm very excited to be here at Holden and to have the opportunity to do this with you for 2 weeks. I hope that you feel the same way about Bible study. It's a great thing. So, those of you coming in, just make sure you grab a Bible. There are some over on the ledge behind you there. No, that's all right. All right, well now let's see if we can start. This is great. It's wonderful to have everyone here. As I was saying to the people who were here earlier, I've chosen to shorten the Bible study today, so when the brunch bell rings at 9:45, the Bible study will end, because I realize that if that bell rings and we're not ended, I'll lose you, and I'll start wanting to go to eat too. So we will end at 9:45, and what that will mean is that we will have less discussion time today, just so you know ahead of time. Can you hear me back there? All right, okay. And the study today is part of a series for the week called Community Issues in Romans. And so we'll be looking at issues having to do with community that I hope will help us here in our life together at Holden and when we go back home to our communities there. The topic that I've chosen to look at today is freedom. Actually, as I had set up a sequence for the week, I started with sin, because that's the topic that Paul begins the letter to the Romans with. But when I got here and realized that this was the 4th of July, I thought maybe I should switch and do freedom first. As I was working on this last night, thinking about the state of the nation and the state of our lives and everything, I thought maybe sin would have been a very appropriate topic for the 4th of July, but I stuck with freedom. So we'll be looking at that topic. And actually, I've chosen three words to go with that we'll be looking at. Slavery, freedom, and speech. Slavery, freedom, and speech are the three related community issues that I want to look at in the book of Romans. These are very American issues, I think, to tie this to the 4th of July as well as I can. You think of the history of our country, give me liberty or give me death. I learned that as a school child, you did too. And I was thinking about Lincoln's Gettysburg Address, talking about how we were a nation conceived in liberty. Free speech is a cornerstone of our nation, and we celebrate the Emancipation Proclamation. These issues, slavery, freedom, and speech, are national issues for us as Americans. They are also issues in Romans, for the Roman community. And I want to look at these issues in Romans and look at them not so much as they work in our relationship with our nation, but I want to look at how these issues play in our relationship with God and with one another. So that will be the focus of our study this morning. If you will you turn with me then to Romans 1, the first chapter, the first verse, and let's start. If you've studied Paul's letters, maybe someone has talked to you about how letters begin. In our culture, how do we begin a letter? We say, dear so-and-so, whether it's a friendly personal letter or a business letter. That's our opening salutation. In Paul's time, it was more typical to begin a letter, Olivia to her daughter, greetings, or Cicero to Apollos, greetings. That's the shortened version of a letter opening in Paul's time. Paul here has the skeleton of that structure, but then he greatly elaborates it. And we won't go into his elaboration today, but just to point out, the first word of the letter is Paul. The writer identifies himself. Then you have to read quite a ways to get to find out who this letter is addressed to. We finally find out in verse 7, to all God's beloved in Rome who are called to be saints. And then comes the greeting. And it's not just greeting. Paul elaborates again, grace to you and peace from God our Father and the Lord Jesus Christ. The first two words of this introduction are interesting to me. How do you begin a letter? It gives you a hint, maybe, of what's coming, what this letter is about. And the first two words are Paul, a servant, my translation says. We could translate that Paul, a slave. In Greek, the words are ron, Apollos, doulos. Paul begins this letter with a little rhyme, Apollos, doulos, Paul, a slave. What is slavery? Paul's calling himself a slave. How do we characterize slavery when you think of it? What do you think of as characteristics of slavery or a slave?
No freedom.
No freedom? Okay.
Working without pay.
Okay, no pay. All right.
Bondage, chains.
Okay, chains, bondage.
You're responsible to someone.
Okay, responsible to someone because you're owned by them. Yeah. Pardon? Okay, ownership, your property of someone. Yeah.
No choices.
Okay, no choices. Your life is determined, set out for you. So are your relationships that way. There's some other characteristics, too, of slavery in the Greco-Roman time that maybe pertain to slavery in general, but that are interesting. I have an article on slavery in the time of Paul. If you'd like to read that, you can borrow it sometime. Thomas Wiedemann wrote it, and he talks about slavery in more ways, too, than we've described. He talks about slaves being at the margins of the human community. It's as far away from being human as you can get and still be human. You know, they're people, but they're almost like they're dead, non-human, at the margins of the community. Another thing that we touched on, I think someone implied it, is that a slave has no right to speak. A slave is owned by someone, and so a slave has no right to speak. And in the literature of Paul's time, you often find people very suspicious of what a slave might say. A slave can't be trusted to speak the truth, is another sense of slavery. Because a slave is owned, a slave has no legal rights, can't appear in a court of law. There are all these ramifications of slavery and being a slave. In Paul's time, we could draw a picture of the society that he lived in, and it would look like a very widespread pyramid like this, with the very wealthy aristocracy in the tippy top of the pyramid, and then free citizens here, and then this whole bottom base of the pyramid holding up this whole society would be serfs and slaves. Slavery in the Greco-Roman society, according to Thomas Wiedemann in this article, took on unprecedented proportions and wasn't seen before or hasn't been seen since, the extent of slavery in Paul's society. So slavery was not a marginal little issue. It was a big part of Paul's culture. Many people were slaves, and the slave-free dynamic worked very much in Paul's time. So how, you know, thinking about this, how would Paul's audience have heard these words? Paulos doulos, Paul, a slave. What kind of letter is this where the first thing the writer uses to identify himself is as a slave, you know, part of the bottom of this society, one who's at the margins of society with no legal rights, no rights to speak. You know, what would you think? Yeah.
Well, it's a real attention getter because a slave shouldn't be writing a letter.
Okay, if a slave can't speak and a slave write, maybe that's an issue there. But an attention getter, too. There's shock, surprise here. What's this writer up to that the first word that he identifies himself with is as a slave? And an issue is for us, too. How do we hear this? Paul, a slave. When we read the letter, how does that word hit us as we encounter this first identification of the Apostle Paul as being a slave? Part of the challenge, I think, for us as readers of the letter is that it's not only Paul who ends up being a slave in this letter. We, by implication, end up slaves also. If you'll follow through with me, in chapter 1, verse 1, Paul, a slave of Jesus Christ, called to be an apostle. There's that word called that Paul uses to talk about himself, a slave and called. Then moving down in the letter into verse 6, Paul addresses the Romans. You yourselves are called to belong to Jesus Christ. And in verse 7, to all God's beloved in Rome who are called to be saints. So Paul has identified himself as called. Now he's saying, you are called. Does that mean that slavery, being a slave, goes along with being called? Reading the letter, that's one of the issues for me. If Paul is a called apostle, and he's talking about us being called, And Paul identifies himself as a slave. Does that mean that I'm a slave with him? It's one of the questions that hovers as we begin this letter. Later on in verse 4, in the middle of the declaration, of the salutation, in verse 4, Paul talks about Jesus Christ being Lord. In verse 4, Jesus Christ our Lord. Does Jesus' lordship mean that we are slaves? That's one of the questions that I think all this language starts to pose for us as we begin to read this letter to the Romans. Paul uses slave language in the first chapter, the first verse, to identify himself, Paulos doulos. Then if we read Romans through from beginning to end, we don't encounter slave language in chapter 2, not in chapter 3, not in chapter 4, not in chapter 5. It's not until chapter 6 that this slave language comes back again. So let's turn to chapter 6, verse 6, where we find this. In chapter 6, verse 6, we encounter this imagery of slavery again. Paul is talking about a change that's happened in us. We know that our old self was crucified with him, he writes, so that the body of sin might be destroyed, and we might no longer be enslaved to sin. Here that word is doulos. The noun is used as a verb. We are no longer enslaved to sin. Implying, of course, that we were enslaved to sin. We have been slaves to sin. But now, with Jesus Christ, we have been freed from that. And Paul goes on in the sixth chapter to develop this idea of how we were enslaved to sin, now we are freed from that. In verse 18, he writes, "And that you, having been set free from sin, have become slaves of righteousness." This is the new slavery for us that Paul presents. No longer slaves to sin, but slaves of righteousness. He's identified himself at the beginning of the letter as a slave of Jesus Christ. Now we are slaves of righteousness. And this point is emphasized at the end of the chapter even more, as Paul writes in verse 22, "But now that you have been freed from sin and enslaved to God," we are slaves to God, he writes, "the advantage you get is sanctification and eternal life." There are two things I want to note here, at least. First of all, being a slave to sin. This is what we were before Jesus' death and resurrection, Paul says. Slaves to sin. This is also what we keep falling back into. We've been freed from that, but we keep falling back into being slaves to sin. This is a challenge for us, I would claim, I guess. Do we really see ourselves as slaves to sin? Do we struggle with our falling back to be slaves of sin? Is this part of our vocabulary that we identify ourselves with? I was thinking about that this morning, you know. Do I say, "Hello, I'm Christine Carlson, I'm a slave to sin"? Is that a thing that we say in our worship on Sunday mornings? In Lutheran worship, we say we are in bondage to sin. That implies some kind of slavery, perhaps. But I think one of the things that we struggle with is that we are perhaps more often like the Jews who come to Jesus in John. And this is, I want to move to this story in the Gospel of John because I think that it points out our struggle with what Paul is saying here. In the eighth chapter of John, and you don't have to turn to this if you don't want to, but in the eighth chapter of John, some Jews who believe in Jesus come to him. In verse 31, chapter 8, and they say to him, "If you continue in my word, you are truly my disciples, and you will know the truth, and the truth will make you free." They answered him, "We are descendants of Abraham and have never been slaves to anyone. What do you mean by saying we will be made free?" I think that's more our attitude about this slave-free issue. You think about our country. We're Americans. We're a democracy. Freedom is one of the values that we treasure. We're the freedom bearers for the world, is how we think of ourselves. Or, on the other hand, we think of ourselves as good people, working for good causes to create good communities. We're free in those ways. Or another way I think this can work for us is that if there are ways in which we aren't free, we understand that as being caused by systemic evil. And if we can just do away with those systemic problems, then we will be free. You know, I think in our country we can tend to think that way sometimes. Yes?
Well, I was just going to say, to me, being a slave to sin means that the temptation to sin is always there. It's always pulling at us.
Okay.
And it's a fight to resist it.
Mm-hmm.
So we're...
Okay, so you'd want to say more that that struggle to resist sin is always there. That's how you understand that. Yeah.
Well, the temptation is always there.
Too. Okay, okay. Well, let's see where that goes, because I think Paul might want to drive it harder than that. That not just the temptation, but that our falling into that temptation so much. But let's see how that plays out here, because that's another dynamic there. So, you know, you can think about that. This would be one of the issues that it would be interesting to discuss, I think. How do we see this slavery to sin? Is that something that we deeply claim for ourselves? Because Paul is wanting to argue that to us, that we are slaves to sin. But are there ways that our culture and our country work against that to make us feel that that's not such a big thing? To us, I think, and to these Jews who came to Jesus believing in him, Jesus answers then in verse 34, "Very truly I tell you, everyone who commits sin is a slave to sin." So there are ways we might want to talk ourselves out of it, but we are enslaved to sin. This is one of the big challenges for us in reading Paul, I think, and we'll look at this more tomorrow as we look at the topic of sin. Paul in Romans presents a deep, pervasive sense of sin in the human community and in the world. He wants very much to argue that on our own, as human beings, we fall into sin, we are victims to sin, and slaves to sin. It's only in Jesus Christ that we can ever be free from that predicament and offered another way to be. So that's the first thing that I wanted to have us reflect about, being a slave to sin. The second thing that is interesting to think about is that, according to this much of Paul in Romans, we've been freed from being a slave to sin to being a slave to Jesus Christ, to being a slave to righteousness, to being a slave to God. Is this really the freedom that we had hoped for? As we're reading, we're freed from from one kind of slavery to another kind of slavery. Is this what Jesus' lordship means for us, that we are now slaves to him rather than slaves to sin? This is a notion that Paul keeps working in the next couple chapters, that we are slaves of God, and he works that notion over and over in chapters 6, 7, and into chapter 8. And then there's a change. We were shocked maybe at the beginning to read Paulos doulos, Paul a slave. We are shocked and surprised, I think, as we come now into Romans 8. And let's turn there. I'm skating a little bit to get us through this material. So you have to take my word for that about 6 and 7. But now we come to 8. And what happens in 8? We've been slaves to sin. Now we're slaves to God. And then in chapter 8, verses 14 to 17, there's a wonderful climax in this letter. And I'll read those verses first, and then we'll look at them. Romans 8, 14 to 17. "For all who are led by the Spirit of God are children of God. For you did not receive a spirit of slavery to fall back into fear, but you have received a spirit of adoption, When we cry, Abba, Father, it is that very Spirit bearing witness with our spirit that we are children of God. And if children, then heirs, heirs of God, and joint heirs with Christ. If, in fact, we suffer with him, so that we may also be glorified with him. I'd like to go back to verse 14. For all who are led by the Spirit of God are children of God. Have I presented this in a way that you can catch the drama of that word, children? For 7.5 chapters, the image that's been given to us by Paul to think of ourselves is the imagery of slave. He's used that to talk about himself, and he's used that to talk about us too. Slaves of God, which is maybe a fine thing, but slaves. And now, after all these words, here comes a new word, a new image, a new name that names us. We are children of God. This is a dramatic moment in the reading of Romans, and I hope you can feel the drama of it too for yourselves. For God could have worked it, I think Paul is suggesting, that we'd be redeemed from being slaves to sin to being slaves to God. And that would be something to be most grateful about, to be a slave of God. That would be a great thing. Sin is a horrible, unpredictable, terrifying owner, taskmaster, slave lord. Much better to be a slave to God, receiving righteousness in this life and eternal life in the life to come. But God gives us so much more than that. And part of Paul's strategy in Romans, I think, is to help us see and feel the grace and magnitude of God's gift to us. Not slaves of God, but even more than that, children of God, each of us and all of us together, children of God. Moving into verse 15 of chapter 8, Paul addresses this shift. He acknowledges the shift in imagery that he's using. For you did not receive a spirit of slavery to fall back into fear, he writes, but you have received a spirit of adoption. And then these words just come tumbling out. Not only adoption, but we cry, Abba, Father. And not only that, but we are heirs, going into verse 16 and 17. And not only that, but we are heirs of God. Not just heirs, but heirs of God. And not only that, but we are co-heirs. We are joint heirs with Christ. You see how this new language just tumbles out and increases over and over again as these verses pile up in Romans. The image in our minds for 7.5 chapters is slavery. Slaves to sin, slaves to God. We're grateful for that. But now in chapter 8, a new status for us, given to us by God, comes tumbling out. From slaves of God to children of God, and not only that, but adopted by God, and not only that, but calling God Abba, and not only that, but heirs of God, and not only that, but joint heirs, co-heirs of Christ. We've gone from being slaves to co-heirs of Christ. And later on in this same chapter, in verse 29, Paul works this with even more language that's wonderful. In verse 29, Paul writes, for those whom he foreknew, he also predestined to be conformed to the image of his son, in order that he might be the firstborn within a large family, says my translation. The Greek says to be the firstborn of brothers. I would like to translate that to be the firstborn of siblings. And the image there is that we are Jesus' sisters and brothers, not only heirs with him, but his sisters and brothers. Our status has changed. And Paul helps us see, I think, other ways that God could have worked it that would still have felt like a good gift. But this is an even more incredible gift, that God gives us adoption and sibling status with Jesus Christ. So we are freed then from slavery to sin, to freedom. But what is this freedom like? That's the next thing I'd like to consider briefly. We are not freed to nothing. You know, we're freed to something, according to Paul. We are freed to adoption as God's children. That's what we are freed to, out of slavery. Neither, though, are we freed to individual freedom. And this is one of the challenges, I think, of Paul's letter to us living in the United States, where individual freedom is one of the great values of our culture. Paul tells us that God frees, Paul tells us that God frees us instead to relationships. To relationships with God, with Jesus, with the Spirit, and to one another. In our relationship with God, we are a child of God. In our relationship with Christ, we are a co-heir, a sibling. And in our relationship with one another, we are siblings together. So it's not that we are freed to nothing, nor are we freed to individual freedom. We are freed to community. Community with God, Jesus, the Spirit, and with one another. That, I think, is one of the things that Paul is pushing very hard here in Romans. Community is the freedom that God gives us. So, slavery, freedom. The last thing I'd like to look at briefly is speech. And then maybe we'll have time to talk a bit about this triumvirate or trio that I'm talking about. Recall what we said earlier. When you're a slave, you have no right to speak. And even when you speak, you have no guarantee that anyone will trust what you say as truth. That's your status when you're a slave. So you're effectively silenced. You have no voice and no access to being a truth bearer. It's only free citizens who can speak. So let's see who speaks in Romans. It's an interesting issue, I think. In Romans, God speaks. That's one thing we find. If we go back to chapter 1, verse 1, we find God talking. Paul writes that he is Paul, a slave of Jesus Christ, called to be an apostle. Who's called him? Somebody's spoken to him. There's a speech act here. God has spoken to claim this one. Then going on down into verses 6 and 7, we find that the ones this letter is addressed to are called. Including yourselves, Paul writes in verse 6, who are called to belong to Jesus Christ. Someone has spoken to us, called us. And in verse 7 also, who are called to be saints, to all God's beloved in Rome. God's speaking is described again in chapter 4. If you'll turn to chapter 4 of Romans with me. And this is a complicated sentence, so you'll have to follow it through with me a little bit. In chapter 4, verse 17, there's a parenthetical clause right in the middle of it. We're going to skip that. But I want to go on just after the parentheses in verse 17 of chapter 4. In the presence of the God in whom he believed, this is Abraham, believe. And then God is described, the God who gives life to the dead and calls into existence the things that do not exist. God here again, God's work is to give life to the dead and to call through speech, to speak into being what is not being, what is dead, what is not existent. So God's work of creating is done through speaking. This is important work of God, I think, for us to remember as we enter the 8th chapter of Romans. Remember, at this point, we are still described as slaves. That's still the image used to talk about us in this book. We are still slaves to God. Marginal. As close to not being human as you can get. Almost virtually non-being. That's how we are. And then in chapter 8, verse 14, God calls us into being. For all who are led by the Spirit of God are children of God, called out of slavery into being children. And now, what's the first thing that we do in response to that? We speak. In verse 15, for you did not receive a spirit of slavery to fall back into fear, but you have received a spirit of adoption. When we cry, Abba, Father, it is that very Spirit bearing witness with our spirit that we are children of God. What is it that marks us as children of God? That we speak, to God, calling God Abba, Father. Yeah?
I wanted to know, does Abba mean something more familiar than the word Father in the book?
That's what I've been told, that it means like Papa. It's a very intimate, the most intimate term. You know, my youngest son calls his father Pop, and the others call their father Dad. When they were very little, they called him Papa. It's those kinds of, that word that children use to talk most intimately to their father is what Abba is. It ends up getting translated father, I think, more often because of when it's translated into Latin, it becomes pater, which is a more formal term for father. And so we lose that Abba, intimate sense of that word. We could say Abba, Papa. Here at Holden, we say Abba, Ima, Mama, Papa. That kind of address, that most intimate address to God, is our speaking. So again, I'm trying to present this. I'm hoping you can feel the drama of this in Paul's letter. We have been silent for 7.5 chapters as Paul has been writing to us. We have not had a word to speak. But as we are named children of God, then we speak. And it's not just that we speak, you know, in general, or speak to a void, or speak someplace. We speak to God, and we use a most intimate term to address God. Abba, Abba. So the things I want to say about this, I guess, is that I think we take so many things for granted. And thinking about this again on July 4th, I suppose this is a day to not take things for granted about our life and our country, the good things and the bad things, a time to assess where we are as a nation. And I hope that Romans today and through the week will give us a time not to take our faith for granted and the elements of God's gifts to us for granted either. Paul has things to say to us in Romans, I think, about the great grace of God. And Paul writes this book in a way to help us see and feel the magnitude of that grace. That we are not slaves, but children, heirs. That we are not slaves, but siblings in community with God and Christ and the Spirit and one another. That we are not silent slaves, unable to speak truth, but that we are speaking children of God, able to call God Abba, able to speak to one another words that witness to God's love. So those were the things that I wanted to lay out quickly today. And I guess the last thing, just talking about our speaking that I'd like to add to that, is that I think Finally, the impact of that in the book of Romans is that our speaking is what shapes us as community, what makes us a community. And I think sometimes we come to Holden and we think, here's the geography, here's the mountains, here's these buildings, here's our meals, all those things. But it's our speaking, confessing God, that brings us together and that makes us a community, that feeds us as a community, informs us and guides us as a community. So that's something, that's an issue that we'll get in toward the end of the week as we talk more about our work, our relationship with our neighbors. But that's something you can be thinking about in the week to come, how speech operates and the gift of speech from God to us for shaping us in community. So are there issues you want to bring up? I tried to finish a little ahead of time. We've got about 3 minutes, I think. Yeah, question up there.
Is, we talked some about the status of slaves in Paul's time. What was the status of children in Paul's time?
That's a real interesting question. Children and slaves had quite a similar status, and you might want to read this article by Wiedemann. He refers to that point. He talks about how language used to talk about children and slaves is quite similar. In fact, same words, pais for child, and you call a slave that too. The difference was that a slave had no future. A slave was a slave for life. A child looked forward to becoming an heir and a free citizen and a speaking active member of the community. So even though language was similar, their lives were very different in the end.
So this change that Paul describes is full of potential, but it's not completely...
It's not completed yet.
Realized.
Right. And we'll look at that in the course of the week as we look more at chapter 8. We'll see Paul working with language to talk about this as accomplished, but yet to come and to be fulfilled. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Was this the era in which children were raised by the slaves? The mother didn't have to bother to take care of the baby? And then did the slave, in effect, get to speak through the children by shaping that child?
I suppose that was, if you were a slave who was a nanny for children or something, that would be a close relationship, I'm sure. That wasn't all that slaves...
Not just a nanny, they were the teacher, the save off the law, it's
The pedagogos, the teacher of the
schoolmaster.
Right. Mm-hmm. Yeah, they often
were... Leaders of Christ, and that was the function of the slave with the child, mm-hmm. be the teacher, the one that shaped the child.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. If the family had an educated slave, that would be a role there too. Yeah. Uh-huh.
One of the things that I find when you're talking about speech and community speech, bringing it into today's world, is that I don't find a lot of hope expressed for our church, our institutional church, or our nation out of the community. You're talking about people speaking in the community, that's something that I find is missing to a large extent. I wonder how other people feel about that.
And related to that, then, you think about the power of speech to shape a community.
Right.
If the speech is hopeless,
right.
How does the community ever envision a future for itself,
right.
then? Because it's not only we shape words, but words shape our words come back and shape us too. So,
and how can we influence anything at all if we're not speaking what it is that we are professing in some other ways?
I don't want to get off on the main point that we've been talking about, but Paul keeps bringing up the idea of being glorified, and that. I'm wondering what's implicit in that word for Paul. It's one that I have a little difficulty with and don't really understand, but one of the things that seems to be a part of it has to do with being within a hierarchy in which someone else may be a slave or lower. And yet when you talk about community and you talk about being siblings together, it very much is not that. Mm-hmm. And I suspect that it's not that with the glorified either, but that it's a kind of a tricky idea in there in this context.
Yeah. Well, that's, we don't have time to go into that term now, but I will try to do that as we, because that is a word that Paul uses quite a bit in this book. That if we suffer with Christ, we shall be glorified with him. It's there. So let's look at that later in the week. Yeah, I'll remember that. Mm-hmm.